going to mug me?
Am I going to mug you?
Is that gorgeous or what, eh?
And I believe I can run a decent marathon.
Download Veely now.
On January the 2nd, 1981, two policemen approached a parked car on Melbourne Avenue in Sheffield, South Yorkshire, to talk with the couple sitting in the front. The officers had no idea they were about to arrest a man who'd murdered 13 women and evaded the authorities for over 5 years.
The relief that the man behind these horrible offences had finally been caught and was behind bars was immense.
Peter Sutcliffe, the man the press were calling the Yorkshire Ripper, had a cold-blooded MO. He was attacking helpless women with a hammer before stabbing them to death with a screwdriver.
The streets became quieter and quieter because on the horizon was this monster called the Yorkshire Ripper.
The whole of Britain was terrified by the elusive murderer who seemed to kill for his own enjoyment.
Peter, in my opinion, was a ruthless, cold-hearted killer who actually enjoyed going out and killing. He got a thrill, he got a buzz.
Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper, had undoubtedly become one of the world's most evil killers. Peter Sutcliffe is one of the most infamous killers in British history. For 5 years, he evaded capture while brutally murdering 13 young women across the north of England. It was an investigation with twists and turns and a case that still haunts the British public to this day.
For years, women and girls felt that simply leaving their homes at night meant taking their lives in their hands.
When Sutcliffe was eventually apprehended on January the 2nd, 1981, it brought an end to a manhunt that had both terrified and captivated the nation. The press had dubbed him the Yorkshire Ripper.
For women, it was a very frightening time, and they were stuck in this awful position of being told they shouldn't go out at night. It had an enormous social effect on the country.
As well as his 13 victims, Sutcliffe had attacked at least 7 more women. His arrest was a huge relief for the under-pressure detectives at West Yorkshire Police.
He attacked at random. We couldn't anticipate his moves. The whole of the north of England was held in a grip of terror, really, by this man. There was a sort of, I can only describe it as a Gothic-type cloud over the area.
But the Yorkshire Ripper's story begins over 70 years ago. Peter Sutcliffe was born on the 2nd of June 1946 in the market town of Bingley on the outskirts of Bradford, West Yorkshire.
He was the youngest of quite a large family. His brothers and sisters were all of strong character. They were all working class, could look after themselves. But Peter was a shy boy and very much attached to his mother.
His mother was somebody who was very much dominated and controlled by his father. So I think he had quite a lot of sympathy for his mum, and he thought the world of her as a child. But Peter was somebody who was quite shy, quite awkward. He was quite skinny and scrawny. And I don't think he ever lived up to his father's expectations. And I think that planted that seed of shame in Peter Sutcliffe that would come to shape the rest of his life.
Sutcliffe's awkward demeanour as a child manifested into a dysfunctional adulthood, demonstrated in his early career choices.
Peter Sutcliffe had a variety of different jobs throughout his life. He worked as a gravedigger for quite a period of time, and it was reported that he stole things from the corpses that he was burying. Now, that suggests to me that he wasn't horrified or repulsed by dead bodies, and that's something that would be quite influential later on.
On Valentine's Day 1967, 21-year-old Sutcliffe met Sonia Schirmer. The pair began a long-term relationship, eventually getting married in August 1974.
The relationship that he had with his wife, Sonia, appeared to have been a decent one, and I think he would have treated her fairly well, because she served a purpose for him. Women like his mother and his wife, he saw as carers and nurturers, people who would look after him. Other women, I think he saw somewhat differently. I think Peter Sutcliffe's view of women is very black and white. They are either Madonnas or they are whores. So they're either these perfect domestic angels or they're these sinful creatures.
These opposing views on women collided with one another when a family revelation dramatically altered 23-year-old Sutcliffe's world. His mother, whom he'd looked up to as a child, had been unfaithful.
His mother had had an affair with a policeman, and his father had decided to confront his wife at a hotel where she was meeting this particular man, and took Peter with him.
Peter's father basically humiliated her and said, look, I know all about what's going on. And the children found out as well. So I think this kind of further cemented ideas as to what women were, what could be expected of them, always to be cautious and wary of them.
I think there was every possibility that after seeing his mother and seeing what happened, that possibly preyed on his mind and affected his attitude towards women.
Sutcliffe began to visit the red light districts of Yorkshire and find solace in prostitutes. But his feelings for these women would soon lead to violence and eventually murder.
It's never been established precisely when Peter started his attacks. The first recorded one, or the first known one, was sometime in 1969 when he was with a friend called Trevor Birdsall. And Peter told Trevor that he was looking for a particular prostitute who owed him money. They cruised Leeds. And Peter told Trevor to suddenly stop the car.
He jumped out of the car, suddenly disappeared, followed her down the street and whacked her on the back of the head, and then ran sweating back to the car and away. The following day, the police came round and confronted Sutcliffe. He acknowledged that he'd struck the woman. He said he'd just given her a light blow with a hand. And because the woman was working as a prostitute, she didn't want any more problems with the police. And so she didn't go ahead with the complaint. Had he been arrested then, had he been listed as somebody attacking a woman in this aggressive way, who knows whether or not it would have been much easier to find him.
Whether there were other attacks between 1969 and 1975, nobody really knows. But his first real attack came in 1975.
By October of that year, Sutcliffe was living with his wife Sonia in Bradford and working as a long-distance lorry driver. On the morning of October the 30th, 1975, just 12 miles away in the Chapeltown area of Leeds, the body of 28-year-old Wilma McCann was discovered in a local park.
Wilma McCann was a Scottish woman who had come down to Yorkshire. She was working as a prostitute. She was very hard up, and it was very difficult for her because she had young children, young family to support. And I think that was the only way she felt she could get enough money.
The attack on Wilma McCann set in motion what would become a clear pattern and regular method of ambush by the killer.
His modus operandi was to use a ball-peen hammer and was to strike them very hard and very fast on the back of the head so they fell unconscious. He used his hammer and hit her over the back of the head, and then he stabbed her 15 times in the neck, chest and abdomen.
But the police were no closer to catching the killer, and 3 months later, on the 20th of January 1976, another woman was murdered in Leeds. 42-year-old wife and mother Emily Jackson, who'd vanished after a night out at her local pub. Emily's son Neil was 17 years old at the time. He remembers receiving the tragic news on that fateful morning.
I've come downstairs. My dad's loading one of the vans up for work, and I'm getting my boots on ready for going to work and having a pot of tea, when they were knocking at the door and it opened the place. And that's when I first knew. And it was first knew when, like I said, for Dad, when the police knocked at the door. I can still remember it plain as day.
Again, a hammer had been used in the brutal attack. Emily had also been stabbed a total of 52 times with a screwdriver. Like Wilma McCann, Emily Jackson had been working as a prostitute to make ends meet.
It was just to help family in dire straits, is what I've been told afterwards. When family were in hard times work-wise, she went elsewhere, but I didn't realise till well after.
This time, police were able to recover from the scene a key piece of evidence. On Emily's right thigh was a very firm and visible footprint from a size 7 Wellington boot.
For some inexplicable reason, he stamped on her thigh with such force that it left an imprint of the sole of his boot on her thigh. Now, police tried to trace that boot, or the manufacturers of the boot, which they did, and then try and find out people who had bought them, but it didn't come to anything.
Once again, the trail went cold. It was over a year until a murder with a familiar MO took place in Leeds. On the morning of February the 5th, 1977, the body of 28-year-old Irene Richardson was discovered. She'd been savagely murdered, another prostitute killed with a hammer. West Yorkshire police were suddenly dealing with a serial killer. What they didn't realise is that this was just the beginning of what would become one of the most infamous series of murders in British history. Less than 3 months after the death of a third victim, Irene Richardson, the killer struck again. On the night of the 23rd of April 1977, 32-year-old prostitute Patricia Atkinson became victim number 4. She was murdered in her own flat, this time not in Leeds, but in nearby Bradford.
She believed that if she invited customers into her flat, she was safe because all the killings had taken place in isolated parks or back alleys. So she thought she was safe, but she wasn't.
The killer hit Patricia 4 times around the head with a hammer and then mutilated her body with a knife. This time, detectives found a clue to link the murders of Patricia Atkinson and Emily Jackson.
The police found the same boot mark on the bedclothes at Patricia's house, Patricia's flat, as they found on Emily Jackson's thigh.
This crucial link confirmed the authorities' worst fears. The killer was expanding his hunting ground and he seemed to have a favoured target. All 4 murder victims had been working as prostitutes.
They were very vulnerable women. It was very easy to persuade them to get into a car. It was very easy to find them. And they were used to not being protected in any way. And so he would be able to drive along, ask them if they were up for business, and they would get into the car. And he realized then that as long as there was nobody watching what was going on, he could do what he liked.
But the next victim would buck the trend and shock the nation. On the morning of the 26th of June 1977, just over 2 months after the murder of Patricia Atkinson, 2 children in an adventure playground made a gruesome discovery. The body of 16-year-old girl Jane McDonald.
She wasn't a prostitute. She was a young girl going home, minding her own business. But suddenly, a schoolgirl was attacked. And that changed everybody's perception of the sort of man they were looking for.
By this stage, if it was a woman who was vulnerable, he was happy to kill them.
Any woman was vulnerable if they were found on the streets late at night.
This latest kill caused a great public outcry. Now, courtesy of the tabloid press, the killer had a nickname, the Yorkshire Ripper.
After Jane McDonald's murder, the press then and television actually became more interested in what was happening.
You have to remember that nothing had happened like this since the Jack the Ripper in London in the century before.
What did become clear was the attitude of that time, because she was described in some newspapers as his first innocent victim, as though in some ways the prostitutes had been guilty of making themselves vulnerable to him. It caused a lot of anger amongst women, amongst feminists, and amongst any commentator with a heart. She was a victim who prompted the police to work much harder than I think they had been working at the time.
What this did in the public mind was actually create mass fear. There was a great deal of fear. And as the killings went on and the attacks went on, That fear increased on a monumental basis. Women were frightened of going out at night. Women questioned where their husbands were, boyfriends were, what they were doing when a particular attack had taken place, and they perhaps weren't where they said they'd been.
The increased media attention in the case intensified the ongoing suffering of the victims' loved ones.
It was flashed everywhere. Don't matter where you went. Papers, TV, buses, placards, it was advertised everywhere. There was no way you could get away from it. It made it harder for me just seeing a photo of a man of being not there to talk to.
With a full-scale manhunt now taking place, West Yorkshire police were desperate to capture the Ripper before he struck again. But he was seemingly always one step ahead. His next murder would take place across the Pennines. On the morning of the 9th of October 1977, the heavily mutilated body of 20-year-old prostitute Jean Jordan was discovered on an allotment in Manchester. She'd been dead for over a week. This time, detectives found an important clue, a newly minted £5 note in Jean's handbag, which led them to a 31-year-old lorry driver from Bradford, Peter Sutcliffe.
The police found the £5 note, they traced it via the banks, and found that it had gone through the hands of probably 300 people, one of them being Peter. Peter was interviewed, but on the night in question, he said he was at a party and his members of his family confirmed that he had been at the party.
The police didn't know it, but they had found the murderer. It would not be the last time Peter Sutcliffe slipped through the fingers of the authorities. Between December 1977 and May 1978, he would kill three more women, all of them prostitutes, all of them bludgeoned to death with a hammer.
I think that the longer that serial killers get away with it, the more bold and the more kind of dramatic their offending becomes and the more prolific they become. Because they've been flying under the radar for so long, they may have even been interviewed by the police and subsequently not charged with anything. They do get to the point where they feel completely untouchable.
On December the 14th, 1977, one woman survived an attack by the Ripper, 25-year-old prostitute Marilyn Moore. She described her assailant in detail to the police and a photo-fit picture was released. By May 1978, West Yorkshire police had interviewed Sutcliffe on seven different occasions, but continually ruled him out of the investigation. Lead detective George Oldfield's attention had been diverted elsewhere.
I'm Jack. I see you are still having no luck catching me. I have the greatest respect for you, George. Good Lord. You are no nearer catching me now than 4 years ago when I started.
What really derailed the investigation, or largely derailed the investigation, was a tape from a chap in the northeast, from Wearside, who sent George Oldfield a tape, which became known as Wearside Jack's tape, in which he said, "You haven't caught me, you've been looking for 4 years," and really taunting the police.
He mocked George Oldfield and said, "Your men are not doing very well. I've done another one and you still haven't caught me." And he had a Geordie accent, a Wearside accent. And as a result of that, the police discounted people like Peter Sutcliffe.
It had been almost a year since Sutcliffe had struck, but early on the morning of the 5th of April 1979, a woman discovered the mutilated and bloodied body of his 10th victim, 19-year-old building society worker Josephine Whittaker in Halifax. The Yorkshire Ripper's 322-day hiatus had come to a devastating end. In August 1979, West Yorkshire police would pay another visit to Sutcliffe's house in Garden Lane, Bradford. Officer Andrew Lapchew will never forget the day he stood face to face with the Yorkshire Ripper.
The reason for going to see Sutcliffe was because his vehicle had been sighted in three red light areas, in Leeds, in Bradford, and in Manchester. Talking to Sutcliffe was like pulling teeth. You'd say to him, "What do you do for a living?" "I'm a driver." "Where do you work?" "Oh, clerks at Shipley." He wouldn't volunteer any information without it being asked from him. And one of our ploys, tactic if you like, an icebreaker, was to say to the wife, now's your chance to get rid of your husband if you want. Now, said jokingly, but it was an icebreaker to put everybody at their ease. With the Sutcliffes, there was no reaction whatsoever, which I found strange, because at least you'd get a smirk or a laugh. He was quite an attractive man, you know, well-groomed, but had no personality, no charisma about him whatsoever, no aura, there was nothing there.
Lapchew felt so uneasy about his encounter with Sutcliffe, he submitted a report to his senior officers suggesting Sutcliffe needed to be investigated further. Lapchew was within striking distance of the forces most wanted.
I had the report typed up and I says, I've interviewed this fella, I don't like him. I says, I've got really bad feeling about it. It's an itch that I can't scratch. Anything to do with the case was attached to the report. And I went directly to Dick Holland in the incident room.
He put in a report to his senior officers that Peter was a person who should be of interest, someone who should be looked at closely. And one of the key things that Mr. Lapchew noticed was that Peter had a gap in his two front teeth. And this, he felt, could mark up or marry up with bite marks found on two of the victims.
He asked me if it was a Geordie. I says, no, it's from Bradford, it's from around these parts. I says, but it's a dead ringer for the Madeline Moore photo fit. And then it hit the roof. If anybody mentions effing photo fits to me, they'll be doing traffic for the rest of the service. It wasn't so bad that I'd had the report rejected. It was the manner of the rejection in front of about 50 people. So I could have crawled under the crack in the door after that tirade. But you've got to remember, these fellas were like gods. That's how much in high esteem we held them.
The senior detectives on the Ripper case were so convinced that the killer was the mysterious Wearside Jack that they dismissed any other suspects. It was a mistake that would soon lead to the deaths of three more women across West Yorkshire.
Police threw all their eggs into one basket and discounted a lot of others and spent many, many man-hours, days, weeks trying to track down Wearside Jack. And that threw the whole investigation into kilter. It really did derail it.
He'd had many escapes, Peter Sutcliffe, during the investigation. He was interviewed a total of 9 occasions. He lied his way out on every occasion, and he was a very good liar. He always had quite a clever excuse as to why he had been somewhere. He had the perfect alibi because he was a long-distance lorry driver, so he had a perfect excuse to be in different places at odd times of the day or night.
I think Peter Sutcliffe was rather amused by what was going on in terms of the manhunt for him. He'd been questioned by the police several times. He was right under their nose on multiple occasions. And even Peter Sutcliffe himself has said, I got to the point where I thought I must be invisible. So he got to a stage where he felt untouchable. He felt so powerful, he thought that he was never going to get caught.
As the police were trying to trace Wearside Jack, Peter then started killing again. And in September 1979, he attacked a young Bradford University student called Barbara Leach.
20-year-old Barbara was found murdered on September the 2nd, 1979, in Back Ash Grove, Bradford, only 200 yards from where she said goodbye to her friends after a night out. The women of West Yorkshire and the surrounding area were living in fear. Prostitutes were particularly in danger. 8 of the 11 victims had been working on the streets.
They were all very, very frightened. They needed to keep working. But there was always this fear that the next man, the next client, could be the Yorkshire Ripper.
He created fear and terror on the streets of West Yorkshire and Lancashire. He was somebody who was striking at night. Nobody knew where he'd strike next. He was absolutely terrifying for people.
The mood across the UK as a whole was stifled and tense, awaiting the next move from the man the public knew only as the Ripper.
We'd never had anything like it. The media coverage was overwhelming about it. So, wherever you were, there was always something about the case. They had £1 million worth of publicity with the hoaxer's handwriting on billboards. Rewards were offered. It was a massively intensive campaign, really, both from a police point of view and a media point of view. And it saturated your whole life.
The problem for the police was the days of before computers. And police in those days would log information on index cards. Because of the notoriety of the attacks and the publicity, the police were inundated with information. They had boxes and boxes and boxes full of index cards, which filled an enormous room in West Yorkshire Police Headquarters.
There's been undue criticism of the police, who made every move with the best intention with the information that they had. You cannot sort of anticipate what a murderer's going to do at random. All the stops were pulled out because all the police wanted from the top to the bottom was for this man to be captured so we could get back to normal everyday policing.
For almost a year, there were no more attacks until the body of 47-year-old civil servant Marguerite Walls was discovered in Leeds on the 20th of August 1980. She'd been hit on the back of the head, and in a change to the usual method of the Ripper, she'd also been strangled.
Ligature strangulation marks are often very characteristic. The ligature will compress the neck, it will often graze it just a little bit, and when the person dies, that area of the ligature mark will go quite yellow, quite hard, and it's usually very characteristic, something that will be identified very quickly.
Now, why he changed his modus operandi, nobody seems to know.
Marguerite Walls was Sutcliffe's 12th victim, but the police were still no nearer to catching him. A month later, in September 1980, 20-year-old student Mo Lee moved from Liverpool to Leeds to complete her degree. She immediately felt the change in atmosphere, having arrived in the Ripper's home county.
So in 1980, I'd just completed a foundation degree in art design from Liverpool. So I ended up going to Leeds to do a fine art degree. But there was a strange atmosphere there. The streets became quieter and quieter, because on the horizon was this monster called the Yorkshire Ripper. There'd be another murder and it'd be closer to home. And we began to realise that as women going out alone, we were pretty vulnerable.
Despite the continued rise in fear across the county, Mo and her friends felt an increased sense of unity against the unknown assailant.
There was a curfew almost on women going out alone. There was that solidarity amongst the women and female friends and the blokes as well, that they'd make sure that they would walk you home.
Mo and her fellow students were an independent group who tried as hard as they could to be unaffected by the events around them. But this would all change on October the 25th, 1980.
I planned to go into the town centre of Leeds to meet a group of friends from art school. And I left that pub, I think it was about 10:15. My friends were saying, oh, we'll walk you into town and you're going to be all right. And I'm like, for goodness sake, you know, I'm absolutely fine. It's not far. I got to the outskirts of the campus and there's a church and you can either take the long way round or you can go through a shortcut street. I made a decision that it would be much easier for me to go through that shortcut and get into town so I could get home safely.
But Mo was not alone.
It was fairly dark, and as I was halfway through, I heard this voice calling to me. So I stopped, and I turned round, and I walked towards this figure, and it was a young man. I thought, maybe I do know him. He was so friendly, so friendly.
But Mo was wrong. He was not a friend or even a kindly stranger.
So I realised I didn't know this chap. And then I realised I was in danger. I just sensed this. And as soon as I started to run really quickly, his footsteps were behind me, getting quicker and quicker and quicker. And the fear, my knees turned to jelly. And all I remember was getting this massive whack on the top of my head. And I saw the ground come up towards me, and that was all that I remember. But it was real fear, like nightmare, deep fear. I've never been frightened before like that, ever, or since.
Fortunately, Mo's attacker was disturbed when a group of students approached after hearing her screams. The next thing Mo knew, she was waking up in hospital.
I was pretty lucky. I think my bones are pretty strong. So the blow to the top of the head has left quite a large dent and crack in my skull. I had two puncture wounds to the back of my top of my neck, just below my skull, and cuts and bruises on my knees and elbows where I'd fallen to the floor.
The police could not be sure the attack on Mo Lee was carried out by the Ripper, but they wouldn't have to wait long before he claimed his 13th victim. On the 17th of November 1980 in Leeds, Jacqueline Hill, a 20-year-old student, was hit over the head, stabbed repeatedly and mutilated. An attack that bore all the hallmarks of the Ripper. But Jacqueline Hill would be Peter Sutcliffe's final victim. Within 2 months, a routine police stop would lead to one of the most sensational arrests of modern times. The capture of the Yorkshire Ripper.
Just after New Year, or January 2nd, 1981, Peter went to Sheffield and picked up a prostitute. On the same evening, a policeman with a lot of years of service decided to show a young rookie round Sheffield.
The two police officers spotted Sutcliffe's car near offices on Melbourne Avenue in Sheffield's red light district. They decided to approach and talk to the pair.
The cops asked, what's your girlfriend's name? He said, I don't know, we've only just met. And the policeman said, you know, I haven't just fallen off a Christmas tree. So he already realised there was something odd going on.
Peter said that he needed to urinate, and the officers let him go up to a wall by the side of the building. While he was away, the young police officer did a PNC check on the registration of the car and found that the plates were false. So Peter was arrested and taken to Dewsbury Police Station.
Once down at the station, Sutcliffe was searched. He wasn't carrying any weapons, but this time detectives weren't going to let him slip from their grasp.
So one of them thought, let's go back to that place where we spotted him and let's see if he did leave anything when he popped out of the car saying he was going to have a pee.
The police returned to the scene of the original arrest.
They found the hammer, the intended murder weapon, and they came back with them. And gradually after that, Peter Sutcliffe realised that the game was up, and eventually he confessed. And his only condition was that he be allowed to tell his wife, Sonia, before it became known to the general public that he was indeed the Yorkshire Ripper.
It had been over 5 years since the murder of Wilma McCann, but detectives finally had the Ripper in custody. All the years of terror for women in West Yorkshire, all the years of frustration for the police had come to an abrupt end. Andrew Lapchew had suspected Sutcliffe may be the Ripper for the previous 2 years. He vividly remembers the moment a fellow officer told him the incredible news.
She came in and says, they've caught the Yorkshire Ripper. I says, what? Really? Who is it? She says, somebody called Peter Sutcliffe. Well, it was like somebody punching me in the chest from the inside. The bottom had fallen out of my world.
Sutcliffe's arrest made headlines across the country.
He is being questioned in relation to the Yorkshire Ripper murders. We are absolutely delighted with developments at this stage.
When Peter was caught, the press was all over it. At the time, it was probably one of the biggest stories since the Moores murders. The capture of Peter was front page headlines and on top of the news for days, not only in Britain, but around the world.
His arrest was greeted with enormous relief. For 6 years, this man had terrorized a large portion of the country. The relief that the man behind these horrible offenses had finally been caught and was behind bars was immense. And that shadow that he cast over the country for those number of years passed.
I think when he was finally apprehended, he would have felt a sense of resignation that this was over, that he wouldn't be able to commit any more murders. But I think he probably would have been a bit shocked as well, because he'd been getting away with it for so long that I thought he'd just be able to talk his way out of it again.
A wave of relief spread across the country, but the announcement came as a shock to the family members of those killed.
I'd seen it on the telly when he got caught, and at first I couldn't believe it. When I started listening to it properly and realising, then I got confirmation through the police. Bit of a relief to say he'd been caught. People felt a bit safer.
Another viewer intently watching the story unfold was Mo Lee.
I was at home in Liverpool and his face appeared on the TV news. It was when he was actually taken from a prison van into a courts, and there was really a good camera shot and I recognised his face and his eyes. I actually fell to my knees. I was alone at home, 6 o'clock news. I thought, that's the man I chatted to. Then I was really horrified because it dawned on me that he had attacked me. So that was my first real understanding that for sure it was Peter Suckley.
On the 5th of January 1981 at Dewsbury Magistrates Court, Sutcliffe was remanded in custody for the murder of Jacqueline Hill. Later on the 20th of February, he was charged with all 13 murders and a further 7 attempted murders.
Once he'd been charged, I think Peter Sutcliffe felt that he had a chance of not going to prison, but of claiming to be mad, and therefore going to a secure hospital where life would be much easier for him. And so he emphasized the fact that he believed God had instructed him to clear the streets, and that it had been the devil, a devilish urge, had made him carry these things out.
The preliminary hearing began on the 29th of April 1981 at the Old Bailey in London. Sutcliffe pleaded not guilty to murder, but guilty to manslaughter on the grounds of diminished responsibility.
The trial judge at that particular hearing heard evidence from 4 psychiatrists, 2 for the prosecution and 2 for the defence.
The judge stepped in and said, we need to be careful here because whilst I don't disagree with these psychiatrists, they're only going on what Peter Sutcliffe has told them. So we need to be very careful about accepting the word of a multiple murderer.
Mr. Justice Boreham decided at the end of it that Peter should stand trial in front of a jury on the charges of murder and attempted murder. And that's what happened.
The trial began on May the 5th, 1981.
And the crowds had waited for hours, some through the night, to watch Peter Sutcliffe arrive from Brixton in the green prison van.
The 14-day trial was essentially a discussion about whether Peter Sutcliffe was, as Judge Mr. Justice Boreham put it, bad or mad. On May the 22nd, the jury had reached their decision.
As each of the 13 women's names was read out, the answer was the same. By a majority of 10-2, guilty of murder on all charges.
This sees the end of the largest murder inquiry in the history of the British police, and we brought it to a satisfactory conclusion.
I think when you look at Peter Sutcliffe's offending behaviour, here's somebody who's very much in control of what he's doing. Yes, his crimes are quite bloody, quite gory, they're incredibly violent, but he escapes, he gets away with it. He picks up again where he left off. He goes prepared to the crime scene. So he's somebody who knows what he's doing. He knows what he's doing is wrong, and yet he's still continuing to do it.
On the 22nd of May 1981, Mr. Justice Boreham sentenced Peter Sutcliffe to 20 life sentences and a minimum of 30 years imprisonment before being considered for parole. He was immediately sent to Parkhurst Prison on the Isle of Wight. Despite being declared sane at his trial, in 1984, Sutcliffe was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia and transferred to Broadmoor Secure Hospital in Berkshire.
There's a real difference between prison and secure hospitals. So prison is a place for prisoners, for offenders. Secure hospitals are a place for people who are ill, who need treatment. A lot of people speculate that his paranoid schizophrenia was something that actually developed in prison. He was somebody who was vulnerable to this anyway, but because of the stress of the circumstances of being in prison, it triggered the symptoms in him.
In 2010, a High Court judge ruled that Sutcliffe's sentence should be increased to a whole life tariff, meaning he'll never be released from prison. And in 2016, Sutcliffe was moved out of Broadmoor and back into prison at Frankland in County Durham. He is, without doubt, one of the most infamous murderers in the UK.
Britain is not a country which has a reputation for serial killers. I think that's why it grabbed the public's attention to the degree that it did. 30 years after Peter Sutcliffe's killing spree, the world is very different, very, very different. You don't see people walking about in the way that they did 30, 40 years ago. Nowadays, everybody's very cautious. Everybody's worried.
I think Peter Sutcliffe has become this kind of iconic figure, this kind of criminal celebrity, and I think we need to be a bit cautious about that. We're going to lose sight of the victims, the people whose lives were lost in his killing spree. It's become more about him than it has about them now.
Sutcliffe's legacy casts a deathly shadow over the lives he took and the lives he left behind.
Peter Sutcliffe is never far from the headlines. You know, barely a few months go past without some mention of him in a national newspaper, and he is a notorious figure.
In the years since his conviction, Sutcliffe has admitted carrying out a collection of other attacks on women, including two back in 1975, before his first murder, Anna Rogulski and Olive Smelt. He's never admitted to the attack on Mo Lee.
Would it make any difference if Peter Sutcliffe confessed that he had attacked me? It just seems so unlikely. I've had to learn to live with the fact that that will never happen.
I just wish you were here. Because I had some good happy times with him, ma'am. I just wish you were here. It breaks my heart knowing my son, my grandson, Dot's here.
Since his incarceration over 35 years ago, Sutcliffe has talked many times about his killing spree, regularly taking the opportunity to seize the limelight. But he's still yet to give a reason for the brutal attacks.
Peter, in my opinion, was a ruthless, cold-hearted killer who actually enjoyed going out and killing. He got a thrill, he got a buzz. Why he did it? Only he knows. He's never actually given a proper explanation. He's never given a cogent reason for killing in the manner that he did.
We may never know how many people Sutcliffe attacked or why he did it, but we can be sure no woman who crossed his path was safe. His reign of terror shocked the world as he evaded capture for over 5 years. The cold-blooded and brutal manner in which he murdered 13 helpless women is why the name Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper, continues to haunt the British public to this day.